Across Syria and the Middle East, scenes of jubilation are beaming across the world as people celebrate the fall of the long-term dictator Bashar al-Assad. What couldn't be achieved in 13 years has now happened in just 2 weeks. Bashar al-Assad took a flight and fled as rebel forces reached Damascus. What does this all mean for Syria? What does it mean for the region? These are unprecedented events, and here to unpick this all for us is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. Adnan, it's just been a crazy week.
Yusuf, that is probably the most accurate to put this.
I think we need to make a confession to our listeners. We did actually sit down earlier in the week.
We did, yes.
And within 24 hours, everything that we discussed was now old news. So we sat down here again to try this again, to try to unpick this for our audiences. I think, yeah, the first question is, how on earth have we got here?
So we sat down, today's Sunday, 8th of December, it's the evening here where we are. So we sat down, if I remember, Yusuf, on Wednesday, and Aleppo had fallen. We were still in shock, trying to understand how, why, where. And there was talk of them going to Homs, then potentially onto Hama. So that will be half the country. So I think our discussion really was a lot about what needs to happen, what they're going to be careful about. We were still in shock, if I remember, Yusuf, just how quickly Aleppo fell.
Yep.
There's a bit more information now. The regime forces that were sent to go and fight for Aleppo, they basically put down their arms and didn't fight. They effectively legged it. They didn't put up a fight. The rebels didn't actually physically need to fight in the end. The rebels were shocked. Turkey was shocked. Israel, I think, is still in a state of shock. America's in shock. Iran's in shock. And I think even the rebels were in shock that they've taken over. I mean, this is the second largest city in Syria. It's the industrial hub. Their aim at the time was, because for a long time there's been talk that the rebels are going to open up a front against the regime. They've been stuck in the north of the country for a long time. It's been on and off. They've been back and forth with Turkey. Turkey was on board. It wasn't on board. There were divisions between the different groups. Then they did it, and even they were surprised. But what they did is they've capitalized on that. And here we are a week later where Bashar's fled. He's now officially been given asylum in Russia. I don't think he realizes that maybe the summers in Syria are quite long throughout the year, because it's the winters that are really long in Russia. But the regime has physically capitulated. Nobody's put up a fight. What we can see now is after 13 years of war, the army, most of them are not being paid. Most of them can see the regime is hollow. They can see Bashar was a spent force, and they weren't prepared to die for him. And that's one by one you find that towns fell. Then in the south of Syria, the rebel groups got together and launched an assault from the south of Damascus. So from the north were the rebel groups that came from Aleppo. From the south, you had the Free Syrian Army, FSA, who came from there. And in the end, the prime minister of Syria, he came on TV and basically said, we're prepared to transfer power over. And on Saturday night, early in the morning, Bashar got on a apparently helicopter that went to the Russian base in Syria. And then he flew out to Moscow. And he is now the latest victim of the region's change. And there's an argument here. Has Syria won the Arab Spring? They've definitely won the first part. Nobody thought it was possible after all this time. But I'm sure, as we're going to discuss, there's actually still a long way to go. A lot of things need to happen. But I think everyone's still trying to work out what how did the regime fall? A regime that was brutal, that looked as though it could never be moved. 2 weeks ago, Yusuf, the rebels were just a small faction on the north of Syria near the Turkish border. In 2 weeks, they've taken over the main heartland area from the north all the way down to Damascus. So everyone's still in shock. I think even the global media is still trying to work out what's happened. And it goes to show again, Yusuf, that we've seen over the Arab Spring, the course of the Arab Spring, you've got these leaders, who long-term leaders, they're brutal, tyrannical, and they look very strong. But what you find beneath it all, beneath the fear, it's just completely hollow and there's nothing there. And once people can overcome the fear and they unite, really the regime's days are numbered. I mean, I remember when Gaddafi fell, this guy's been in power 40 years, he would have thought he would have gone. I'm sure Bashar at the start of this year never thought by the end of the year he would be gone. I'm sure Sheikh Hasina, when she won the election in Bangladesh in January, she thought she'd probably in here for a whole term. So that's why I'm not surprised we're seeing the scenes of jubilation. You're seeing the sermons in the mosques. You're seeing people celebrating, not just in Syria, but actually outside Syria as well. So this is definitely a very pivotal moment in the region.
I'd agree. I think it is a question that needs to be asked. Has Syria won the Arab Spring? But before we get to that, it seems like these events, they came out of nowhere. I mean, the ceasefire was a few years ago. Arab Spring started end of 2010, 2011. It's been a long time and everything seemed to have gone cold. And then suddenly out of nowhere last week, Aleppo fell, then Hama, then Homs, and now Damascus. Is it right to actually say that these events came out of nowhere, or is there something else that we're missing?
So it feels and appears it's come out of nowhere because we're outside the country and there's a lot of things you wouldn't see unless you're on the ground. What we know, for example, the rebel groups were planning an operation on Aleppo for a couple of years. This year, actually, they've been preparing. There's been some differences with Turkey. Turkey tried to delay on one occasion. On other occasions, Turkey was supporting it, then it would change his mind. The regime, for example, Yusuf, they sent 6-7 months ago, they were sending tanks to the northern areas. So they knew this was coming. There were talks going on between the regime and Turkey, and sometimes Russia and Iran would intermediate. And what was going on is Bashar basically wasn't playing ball. His view was, I've got nearly 95% of the country under my control. Why do I need to compromise? Why do I need to negotiate? That's what Turkey was trying to do. And what Turkey was trying to do is the northern areas, let's just make it autonomous. Turkey would provide security. Let's keep it autonomous. Obviously, Bashar's view is, I'm the legitimate leader of the country. I represent the whole country. The Arab League and the West were even talking about normalizing relations because he's won. So this was a surprise to us. But actually, for people in Syria, this was a long time coming. What surprised everyone and even the rebel groups was the capitulation of the regime. They were expecting months-long operation. In fact, we know now, Yusuf, their operation was only for Aleppo, but they thought Aleppo would take so long to seize from the regime. But the regime capitulated in days and they realized that there's nothing there from the regime. It's just hollow. Nobody wants to fight. They've had enough. There's even differences with the Alawi support base of Bashar. So then they're like, okay, we might as well go. And effectively, they did what people do in a coup, which is you create expectations. And when you create expectations, people's behavior is shaped by it. So what ends up happening is people just assume everything is coming to an end. So they start acting as though things have ended, even though the action you're doing hasn't happened yet. So what in effect happens is it becomes self-fulfilling. So that's what's happened. We've been hearing for days, Damascus, they're coming to Damascus. And in the end, army personnel have basically put down their arms. They've not bothered to fight because they thought it's all over, even though the rebel groups hadn't even actually got there. So this hasn't come out of nowhere. Well, what I did find interesting, Yusuf, just today I was looking at some of the rebel groups and all I see is them in vehicles, pickups, and I see very, very light weapons. I haven't seen heavy weapons. I haven't seen artillery. I haven't seen heavy bombs. I haven't seen them moving military equipment. So really, even if there was a fight, the military advantage probably would have been with the regime. So the fact that they capitulated and called it a day is the reason why the rebels have won. The rebels haven't won because they overwhelmed Bashar's forces. They haven't won because they outgunned them. They haven't won because their strategy led to them capturing lots of equipment or catching them off guard. They've actually won because the people, the opposition they're fighting, they threw in the towel. Now, why they did that, was the order from the top or not, that we're going to probably have to wait and see. But the fact that Bashar was in Russia last week when Aleppo fell, and then he wasn't seen actually in the country, he didn't even go on TV to make an announcement that he's back, rally the troops. That would indicate that it basically became self-fulfilling in the end. So this hasn't come out of nowhere. There is still a lot of details, Yusuf, we don't know, which will probably come out in the next days or weeks as well, on terms of what specifically led to the collapse of the regime. But definitely this didn't come out of nowhere.
You mentioned that the regime was very hollow. It was very fragile. So my question is, how has the Assad regime of a father and son, how has it lasted for 5 decades, particularly after the Arab Spring? How come it didn't fall then?
So the regime, Yusuf, so the Al-Assad regime, they've been in power since, I think, the late 60s, so a good 50 years. And there's two reasons we look at this. There's internal and external. What you find internally, Yusuf, the Al-Assad regime, they established a repressive state, which their support base was the Alawis. And what they did is they oppressed the majority of the people who were Sunni, and they maintained this secret state. This kingdom, as they call it, It's not of the kingdom of silence. Literally, they say the walls have ears, don't say anything.
I remember, Yusuf, a few years back, I was talking to someone from Syria in London, and I started talking about the regime, and he literally just went pale.
We're sitting in London.
He comes from a place where you never talk about the regime. Your mum, your dad, your friend, your colleagues at work, they are potentially all spies for the regime. So even in London, he grew up with that. And even though we're like out of the country, his behavior and sentiments have been shaped by that. This was the state that the Al-Assads established. It was a very cruel state, Yusuf. It was a sadistic state. This is the country America chose for its black sites. This is the country after 9/11, America will send people that legally it wasn't allowed to torture. So they will send them here because there's no law and order. I don't know if you've seen, Yusuf, on the news channels, they are showing the release of prisoners from the Sadnaya prison.
Yeah, I've heard about that prison. There's a name for it. Remind me of the name.
It's not coming to me at the moment, but I think everyone's going to know which one we're talking about. So this is the one where you've got a kid in there. The kid's born in prison. That's how long he's been there. You got it full of women. And I was just reading earlier, Yusuf, the prisoners that were freed were only freed who were in prisons on the surface level, on the ground floor. They told them that there's three or four stories underground, subterranean. And what's happened is the prison guards, they've all gone. So they couldn't get the gates open that go deep into the ground. This is the type of regime these guys established. So literally, the way they maintain control is through monitoring people, and people disappearing was normal.
The name comes to me. It was called the Human Slaughterhouse.
This is it, the slaughterhouse. It literally, a meat grinder.
Yeah,
you forget. So you've had people come out who actually thought that Iraq has invaded, as was the case potentially in the 1980s, and they've liberated them. So that's how long some of these people have been imprisoned. I saw a report of another guy. He was told to shoot upon civilians during the Hama massacre, 1982. And he refused to do so. He was thrown in prison. He's just come out now. You had other individuals. Today was their execution day. So one of them goes, when the rebels came and they were shouting, Allahu Akbar, and there was a lot of noise, they just thought they've come, that must be the line of all the people getting executed. And obviously everyone's screaming until they worked out that the regime been overthrown. So this was the state that's been established. That's how they maintain their position domestically. The other thing the regime also did, Yusuf, is they spread this nonsense, really, that they're anti-imperial. So you find there's a lot of people in the world who believe that America is very critical of this country, and that's because this country stands against imperialism. Iran, with Syria, with Iran, with the axis of resistance, they're trying to oppose the American plans and American agenda. This obviously was complete nonsense, because really, he's a tyrant. That's what he was doing. He was hiding behind these sort of things. This is internally, Yusuf, how they maintain their power for so long. The other thing was external. What Bashar al-Assad did and what his father did is they supported foreign powers in their plans for the region. So despite all the talk of being anti-American, despite all the talk of America criticizing Syria, you find time and time again, Syria and America found ways to work with each other. And the reason why Bashar al-Assad did this is they realized that they can be overthrown from a foreign power. They can be overthrown from a regional power. So to ensure that never happens, what they did is they would actually get involved and achieve the agenda of foreign powers. So foreign powers realize that Syria is useful to work with. And there are loads of examples of this. We saw this in Lebanon when Syria invaded and it maintained America's position there. In the Iraq War, both Iraq War, Syria sided with America. As I mentioned, Syria was a site for America's black sites, for CIA torture. And you find, Yusuf, that when it came to Israel, Israel has admitted that their most secure border is the one where the Golan Heights are with Syria. So Bashar al-Assad's father, they never planned to take back the Golan Heights. They've never fought Israel. So when the Arab thing started in 2011, Yusuf, retired generals, retired intelligence officers were all coming out saying, we can't afford for Bashar to fall. If Bashar falls, we are going to lose our bulwark who's defending us. So what you find is the rhetoric between Israel, Syria, a lot of that was for show. Really, Syria actually has been the most stable border area for Israel. Internally, they were repressive, and externally, Syria had no agenda for the region. What Syria did, it achieved the agenda of other powers. And that's why other powers, despite their rhetoric, they had no problem working with these guys. So I do find it farcical when you've got all these officials coming on media now
and they're saying it's a great day, this repressive regime's gone. These Hillary Clinton, when the Arab Spring started, she called Bashar al-Assad the reformer. She said, we need to give him time. He was being wined and dined in 10 Downing Street. He was being wined and dined by the royal family in the UK. And recently, at least the last year or so, Yusuf, the West, the Arab League, they were welcoming him back into the fold. So this is why the al-Assad family's repressive regime was able to last for 4 or 5 decades.
Putting the hypocrisy of the rulers, the Western rulers, the media aside, you're generally finding that people have celebrated the fall of the Assad regime. And it would seem that actually the country is unified. But there's another side to this. There's a lot of sectarianism. There's a lot of different factions in that. Are those factions really that deep? Is the separation between them really that severe? Can they actually come together to actually build a stable Syria?
So you got a couple of things there, Yusuf. The al-Assad regime, they use sectarianism in order to unify their ranks and to get the minorities behind them. So their narrative is, because we're Alawis and we're in power, the Sunnis will always want to overthrow us. So you Alawis, you Druze, you Kurds, you need to support the Alawi regime, but only the Alawi regime can defend you and protect you against the majority Sunni. That's the narrative they pitch. So that's why when the Arab Spring took off in 2011, Bashar al-Assad resorted to sectarianism straight away. He goes, there you go. I've always told you this, that they're going to rise up against us. They're going to kill us all. We need to band together and defend it against these majority. But the thing here is, if Bashar al-Assad was a Sunni Muslim, as many of the rulers were in the Arab Spring, the assumption here is that people wouldn't have risen up. The people rose up because they were oppressed. They had no rights. They lived in a repressive state. The ethnic background, the religious sect of the leader is irrelevant. So in Egypt, Sunnis rose up against the Sunni leader because he was oppressive. His beliefs got nothing to do with it. In Yemen, Ali al-Abd al-Saleh is Houthi, like the Houthis who rose up against him. In Libya, Gaddafi is Sunni and his people were Sunni and they rose up against him. So this, again, it's really just a propaganda argument to deflect from the oppressive and tyrannical nature of the regime. If you oppress the people, if you create injustice, you will have a simmering unrest, which will eventually turn into an uprising. And we've seen that across the world, beyond the Middle East, and you've seen it here again today. So again, this is really, it's to muddy the waters that this is all sectarian. And unfortunately, I think sometimes Western media, because they like to use very simple binary, they will say this is a Sunni Shia issue. This is a sectarian issue. This is an Arab versus somebody else issue. And actually, this comes down to very basic. You had a tyrannical ruler who, quite frankly, maintained rule via iron grip. And people rose up because they'd had enough.
There's a lot of talk about the rebels, labels such as jihadists, Islamists, terrorists, extremists, everything. They're all being thrown around. Can you tell us more about these rebel forces? Who are they aligned with? Who backs them? Where did they come from?
Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. The uprising in Syria, what you find is people organized into groups and they all had different names. They were named after Sahaba. They were named after great rulers of the past. And there's been a lot of groups that came together. There's been a lot of splits. But what you find, the Syrian uprising was the people. And then you had the groups who took up arms in order to defend themselves when the regime came down on them. So there's a number of groups, really. Probably the most important, The group that's getting the most coverage is the HTS, which is led by Abu Muhammad Jilani. So this is actually a coalition of various Islamic-minded groups, along with some groups that are national. So this group, obviously, there's a lot of talk because Jilani was part of Al-Qaeda in the past. He fell out with them. Then he's with them. He's not with them. So this group, they're getting the most attention, but there were only one group amongst many. And as far as I know, the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, they're actually around 20 plus groups that actually came together. Then you've got the Syrian National Army, the SNA. So this is a Turkish-backed group. So this is a group, again, it's a coalition of groups. And they have worked on and off with HTS. And what you find is they've actually spent most of their time fighting the Kurds, the Kurdish groups. Some of the SNA, they actually went to fight in Libya. They went to fight in the Caucasus. They've even gone to Africa on behalf of Turkey. So this group is very, very close to Turkey. And you find, Yusuf, with all the different factions, they've taken arms from different countries. They have trained with different countries. They've gone to the countries to get training. Some of them have gone to conferences as well. Quite a messy scenario here. And there's a lot of different times where groups come together. They fight against each other. They fight separately with other groups. So this is quite common. So the other groups you got is the FSA, the Free Syrian Army. So this is a group that first emerged when the uprising started, and they're from the southern areas of Syria. And this is a group that took over the southern areas and then they went to Damascus. So this group consists mostly of former soldiers who defected. So one of the reasons why Bashar originally struggled against the uprising was a lot of his army defected. They refused to actually fight. So many of these guys went on to form the Free Syrian Army. And these guys have taken arms from all sorts of different countries. And the last one you've got is the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces. So this is the Kurdish-backed groups. So this group's been backed by America. America actually has a military presence in the northeast of Syria where the Kurds are. So this is probably the best way to codify the group. So what you've got there, Yusuf, is multiple factions. Sometimes they come together, sometimes they don't. They've got different ideologies. Some of them have got different interests. Some of them are more nationalistic. Some of them are a bit more Islamic. Some of them are a bit more pragmatic. So if you look at Abu Muhammad Jilani, he's changed his stripes so many times. He fought against the American forces in Iraq. Then Al-Qaeda sent him to go and join the revolution in Syria. He went to Syria. He fell out with the Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of Al-Qaeda or ISIS in Iraq. He then got in touch with Zawahiri, the central leader of Al-Qaeda, and they managed to sideline Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Then the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Baghdadi, he announced the merger of the two groups, which Jilani refused to do. So Jilani has changed his stripes quite a few times. And his rule in northern Syria has a lot to be desired as well. So you've got quite a complex mixed picture. However, Yusuf, they managed to come together and take over Aleppo and then drive all the way down to Damascus. And you can see, Yusuf, all the news coverage. People are welcoming them. People are celebrating them. People want them to take over. So there's still a long way to go, which I'm sure we're going to discuss. But yeah, multiple groups came together. So the people of Syria rose up. Then they organized into groups. Many people from these groups came from outside Syria to be part of the revolution. Many people within Syria joined these groups as well. And today we're in the scenario where they've managed to overthrow the regime.
One of the things that actually got me thinking was the timing. And I think a lot of people have been discussing the timing. It was straight after the ceasefire with Hezbollah. Many people are actually suggesting that the rebels are hand in hand with Israel. Where do these events in Syria leave Israel? And what is its regional position now?
Mm-hmm. So if we look at Israel's relationship with Syria, what you find is the Golan Heights, which is the area of contention. The Syrians have never done anything or even demanded it back. And as we know, many, many Israeli officials have made very positive statements about the Al-Assad family, about the regime, and how that side of Israel is its more secure border. But Israel has always had a problem with the regime in Syria's closeness to Iran and Hezbollah. So Israel views Iran as, they call it the octopus. So Iran's the head of the octopus and all the tentacles, yeah, that's Hezbollah, that's Hamas, that's the Houthis. And that's Syria. So this was always a problem for Israel. And when the Arab Spring kicked off, it was a big problem. Because the Arab Spring, the attempt was to overthrow the regime. And the regime for Israel, despite all its rhetoric, has always maintained its border and kept it stable. And that's why you find that many Israeli officials 13 years ago came out in support of us. They said, we've got to make sure it doesn't fall. He's actually been the best one. In fact, it was actually quite shocking. Usually these sort of things where you are publicly against a leader, but behind closed doors, you're on the same page. This came out completely in public. That's how worried Israel was. When the Arab Spring happened, the Arab Spring was a challenge to the architecture of the Middle East and the architecture's war. None of these rulers are going to war with Israel. Even the rulers that criticize Israel, it's nothing more than words. They don't physically do anything. So when people are rising up, that's a big problem. So that's why you find Israeli officials came out really in support of Al-Assad and how this is such a big risk for them. What did happen, Yusuf, is when Arab Spring started, people rose up across the country in Syria and then they organized into groups. Now, what happened was in the south of Syria, you had quite a few rebel groups. And so the rebel groups effectively were in between Damascus on one side and Israel on the other side. So some of these groups reached out to Israel from the perspective that, look, we got no problem with you. Our problem is Bashar al-Assad. So basically, don't bomb us from behind. And what Israel did was Israel was worried that these rebels could turn against them. They've got weapons. So what Israel did is it reached out to some of these rebel groups. But apart from this communication, it doesn't seem anything went further than that. And then also what we could see, Yusuf, is the Israel is not on the same... The rebels want to overthrow the regime. Israel has never been for overthrowing the regime. Israel is critical of the regime relationship with Iran. It's critical of the regime's relationship with Hezbollah. But in terms of protecting and defending the Golan Heights and now border, Israel's completely in bed with them. So the rebels who want to overthrow them are on a completely different page to Israel. So now, obviously, if you look, Yusuf, with the regime falling, what's happened is Israel's already defeated Hezbollah, which has been its problem with the regime in Syria and its relationship. It's defeated Hezbollah, completely weakened them. And what you find is with the rebel groups, they want to overthrow the regime, and the regime is being held up by Iran and Hezbollah. So there is a shared interest there. Israel has a problem with Iran and Hezbollah, and the rebels have a problem with Iran and Hezbollah. But the reasons for why they have a problem with these guys and what they want to do is completely different. So although they hate the same people, the reason for why they hate them and what they want to do is completely different. And this is important because I think a lot of people are saying the rebels are backed by Israel. But actually, what the rebels want to achieve and what Israel wants to achieve is completely different. So that's why, although there was some communication with some of the groups in the southern areas of Syria, it didn't go beyond that because they've got two completely different objectives.
I was reading on the news today that Israeli occupation forces accompanied by tanks have actually crossed into Syrian territory from the occupied Syrian Golan Heights and are now occupying southwestern Syria. They've actually ordered, I think, 5 Syrian villages, the people in there, to not leave their homes. What's going on here?
Yeah, so if you've got into a foreign sovereign country and telling people what to do, that's called an occupation. So what Israel's done, Yusuf, is it's taken advantage of the moving, very fast-paced moving situation to do something it's always wanted to do. So although they like Bashar al-Assad, they had a big problem of his relationship with Iran and Hezbollah. So Hezbollah's supply line used to go through Syria. So it goes from Iran through Iraq, through the south of Syria into Lebanon. So what Israel is doing is, as things are up in the air, as there's no regime to even protect Syria, what they've done, they've taken advantage. They've sent their tanks in, they've sent their jets in. And what they've been doing is they've been striking bases, intelligence units, and even industrial units. What they're doing is they're making sure no weapons fall into the hands of the new regime, and they're making sure Hezbollah or Iran cannot take advantage of these weapons. Now, this is something they've always wanted to do, and now they've got the situation and environment where they can actually do it. The other thing to keep in mind, Yusuf, Israel has been very clear that for its security, it wants to create a buffer zone around Israel. In other words, they want to conquer and seize territory. So they've done that in Gaza already. They're depopulating in Gaza. In Lebanon, from the Lebanese border with Israel up to the Litani River, that's about 18 miles, they want that to be a buffer zone. Meaning, we know it's your country, but for our security, we don't want anyone living there. And they've always wanted to do that where the Golan Heights is with Syria. So what they're doing is they're taking advantage of the crisis in Syria to actually enact this now. In any other place, Yusuf, this is an invasion and occupation. In any other country, if anyone did that, if someone was to say, if the French were to say in the UK that for security, we need a buffer zone in from Cornwall down to Kent up to Essex, is laughable because the UK is sovereign territory. That's what Israel's doing. What Israel's doing is taking advantage of that. No one's going to do anything. Who's going to do anything? You've just had an uprising. Things are up in the air in Syria. So they're taking advantage of the situation there.
Do you think that the rebels, they will respond eventually when they get things organized?
In the short to medium term, I can't see them doing anything. They've got bigger issues to deal with. We're Sunday night, Yusuf. Saturday night, which is what, 12 hours ago, Bashar al-Assad fled. They're not in any position to start firing. They're not in any position to defend the borders. They're still trying to transfer power from the old regime and institution to the new one. So I can't see them really doing anything for either the medium to long term at the moment. And even when they have got internal stability, they've got bigger issues to really deal with. You know, this is a country being at war for 13 years. The Al-Assad regime destroyed infrastructure. They destroyed towns. If you look at some of the towns, Yusuf, when the rebels were driving up to Damascus, they look like apocalyptic scenes from these Hollywood movies. You've got like homes which are completely destroyed. So they're in a position. And it's not just a matter of firing a couple of rockets, Yusuf, at Israel. You fire a couple of rockets, Israel will do even worse. So it's just priorities at the moment. And what Israel's doing, Israel doesn't need instability to do this. You look at what they do in Gaza. Look at what they do in the West Bank. What they're looking at is, whilst they might have loved Bashar, they had a problem with his relationship. So what they're doing, they're fixing that reality now because they've got the opportunity to do that. So they're making sure whoever's in power in Damascus, they've got very few arms to threaten Israel with. They've got very few weapons. And more importantly, they have always been targeting Hezbollah and Iran and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria. They always target them because for Israel, Iran is the threat in the region. And Syria's relationship with Iran was always a problem for them.
I want to get to Iran and the wider region in a moment. Just one last question about the rebels themselves. Obviously, the top of the regime, I think everyone's now just watching to see what happens. What kind of government would be established? Is it going to be very secular? Is it going to be authoritarian? Is it going to be Islamic? What are your thoughts on this?
The Arab Spring is, 13 years old. It doesn't have a good track record once regimes get overthrown. If you look at Egypt, it's gone back to an authoritarian leader. If you look at Tunisia, where it all started, factionism has completely destroyed the country. If you look at Yemen and Libya, it's civil war. So the Arab Spring doesn't have a good record. However, that doesn't mean Syria has to turn out like that. Now, I think what you're going to find, Yusuf, is the political process between the rebel groups is going to begin. And there are many, many rebel groups. You know, these are groups that have sacrificed. These are groups that have fought with each other, sometimes against each other, sometimes against the regime. So a political process will start. It will begin. The feelers that have been coming, Yusuf, from these rebel groups. So Mohammad Jalani gave an interview to CNN, I think Friday night, Saturday morning. And he's talking about inclusive government, rights for everybody, a transitional government, and then elections for a full legitimate government. He's talking about territorial integrity. So that doesn't suggest they are looking to make major structural institutional changes. Now, because these guys have been fighting Yusuf for so long, they've not really had the time to sit down and talk about a post-regime scenario. In fact, if you were to ask any of these guys, Yusuf, last weekend, if they believe by the following weekend they'll be in Damascus with the keys of power in their hands, they would have laughed at you. But that's where they are. So they're talking about a transitional period. Then they're talking about establishing some sort of representative system. They haven't said anything about the old regime, Yusuf. They haven't talked about, will Bashar al-Assad be held to account? Again, Bashar al-Assad is one person, Yusuf. No regime is one person. You need institutions and structures and systems. All this repressive system, are they going to be held to account? Are you going to close them down? Are you going to continue with them? Nothing. You've not heard anything of what they plan to do with the old regime and old structures. And as a result, we've not heard about what the system would be. There's no charter. There's no broad guidelines that they plan to actually go by. So this potentially, Yusuf, opens up to a number of potential problems. So the power that the different groups have, that could become an issue. So you might find that opposing groups, this could potentially lead to violence. So the Kurds, for example, Yusuf, in the northeast of the country, they want autonomy. They're not talking about an inclusive government. They want to be part of it. They're talking about autonomy. That could potentially be a problem. Because you've got so many groups, you could eventually have a very fragmented government. And this means progress will be very slow because you've got so many people involved in the process. And if there's any conflict, Yusuf, because of the different groups, it could be prolonged. And this potentially could lead to a power vacuum that leads to all sorts of other issues. Now, I think the Syrian people will ensure the more extreme things don't happen. The Syrian people have been fighting, surviving for the best part of 13 years. What they want is just a system that serves them. It gives them rights. It doesn't oppress them. It doesn't cheat them. For the moment, that's what the people want. And I'll just finish, Yusuf, with the rebel groups could change very little. And that will just make the last 13 years all in vain. If you fool for 13 years and all you're doing is changing a couple of faces, but you're going to keep the whole underlying system. Well, that is technically what was being offered to you in all these international conferences. Like it would just be such a waste of lives. If all you do at the end is you remove Al-Assad, you come to power, everything else remains the same. Because a country, Yusuf, is system, is structures, institutions. These were used, built, funded to oppress the people. And as we saw, Yusuf, all the announcements of the rebels taking over generally came from the mosques. You see people shouting the takbirs, they're making dua. So this shows you where the people's sentiments are. So these sentiments need to be represented, otherwise potentially that's going to create quite a big problem. I haven't seen much at the moment what they plan to do. The feelers leave a lot to be desired that they've been putting out. I think Jilani, who seems to change his stripes all the time, he seems to be trying to present a moderate, stable force. So we'll have to wait and see. But fundamentally, you know, the people expect them to deliver. The people expect their sentiments to be represented in what happens now. So I think compared to other countries, if the rebel groups take over and they don't deliver, I don't think the people will be having it. And now the barrier has been breached, which is we can't overthrow the regime. It's too strong. That's been breached. It means that people can always come out on the streets again. So it's definitely something we'll be watching on the geopolitics going forward.
Let's discuss the region now, because there was a lot of powers that were involved in Syria. With the fall of Bashar al-Assad, I think the main one that comes to mind is Iran. Iran was a very close ally. It was part, Bashar al-Assad, along with Iran, was part of the axis of resistance. Is Iran now on retreat in the region? Has it got a plan B? Because it seems like all its allies are in tatters at the moment.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the last year, since October 7th, Iran's been in retreat. One by one, all its proxy groups, so the Hamas, Hezbollah, even the Houthis, they are all being targeted by Israel. Now, Israel really in the last year has been trying to weaken Iran in the region by targeting its proxies. So we've seen what they've done to Hezbollah. They've taken out their whole leadership. We've seen what they're trying to do to Hamas. They keep launching strikes on the Houthis as well. So for Israel, the strategic issue for them in the region is Iran and weakening Iran and its proxies. So by removing or by the departure of Bashar al-Assad, that does actually weaken Iran, because that was the leader in the region. He was very close. Now, interesting, on Saturday, Iran, Russia and Turkey were all in Doha for talks. And in those talks, Iran didn't say it was going to aid or intervene for Bashar al-Assad. So this was Saturday during the day. So that's why I'm not surprised Bashar got the message that they're not coming to save him. And that's why by Saturday morning, he was gone. So it would seem, Yusuf, that Iran had concluded his days are numbered. The odds are against him in the region. They're on retreat because of what's happened to Hezbollah. And keep in mind, Iran has significant domestic issues. There's protests going on inside the country. The clerical regime is struggling to survive. I will just add, Yusuf, there is a real possibility that Iran has actually made a deal with the US, which is we retreat from the region, which is what Israel's problem is, that these guys have expanded too much in the region, in return that they can maintain their nuclear program. The reason why I say this is Israel has admitted for two decades that they have struggled to penetrate Hezbollah. They've struggled to work out their structure. They, in a matter of a week or two, were able to identify and take out nearly all of Hezbollah's leadership. Now, the only one who has all that information and their whereabouts is the Iranians. So there is a real possibility, Yusuf, that Iran actually has made a deal that they can see the region moving against them. They can say Israel has managed to influence many US officials that targeting Iran is in America's interest and their interest.
Adnan, come back on you on that. I've been reading a little bit about this and the weakness of Hezbollah and their leadership. And from my reading, it seemed like they were exposed after they entered Syria to help Bashar al-Assad during the first period of the Arab Spring. But you're saying something different. How do we marry these two up?
So definitely, even Hezbollah has admitted that their entry into Syria, remember, Hezbollah was established to be a guerrilla group to defend Lebanon. So their focus has always been Lebanon, and the focus has been about Israel who come into Lebanon. So they're not established for offensive action. They're not established to go 100 miles into a foreign territory and conduct a war. That's a completely different type of warfare. Their training is all about how do we make it hell for someone who wants to come in the territory we're in. So they do guerrilla warfare, you know, they do bombings, they set traps. So when they went to Syria to defend the regime, you had mid-level leaders. They had to engage with Syrian intelligence. They had to engage with Russia. And that, for the first time, opened up and gave access to intelligence officers who used electronic communication to work out who's who. But still, Yusuf, to have taken out the whole of their leadership, you still need a lot more information, very precise information, which not most people won't have. So I actually feel that there's a real possibility. So not definite. I actually think it's possible because the reason why you have proxy groups, Yusuf, is firstly, you arm the proxy group and they fire off their own resources. If they're successful, you get credit. If they fail, it's not your own troops. It's not your own army. Also, if you can drop that group because they're no longer useful anymore. So a good example, this is Wagner. Russia's Wagner, it became a problem. So they basically got rid of half of them and the other half they took into the army. If Russia has sent its own army to a country and the army refused to fight, you've got a massive problem. So I think this is a real possibility. Again, we'll have to wait and see with time. We find what happened. This, my calculations are, Yusuf, is to take out so many guys at the highest level. The information, because that information won't be available to most people even in Hezbollah, because they maintain quite a deep level of security. So I think this is potential, but obviously, you know, we have to wait and see. And actually what you find of, as Hezbollah has been taken out, as Hamas has been taken out, Iran's actually been quite reluctant to get involved. So if you look, even when Iran bombed Israel, they telegraphed it to the whole world. It was like, we're launching bombs at you because we have to look good, but we're just telling you we don't plan to do anything major, so don't get the wrong idea. So this is why I think there's actually a possibility that Iran's just cut a deal with America. And they can see the odds are against them. They can see a lot of American officials are with Israel. So let's just go into retreat. And they've just made a deal that, look, we'll step back because we can see things are going in a certain way in the region. And in return, look, just let us maintain our nuclear program. We'll do it. I think there's a real possibility for that. But definitely, Yusuf, the fall of al-Assad, it has a major impact. So Iran used to always talk about this pathway to the Mediterranean. Sometimes they call it a Shia crescent. So you got Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, then you've got the Mediterranean Ocean. That's now been cut. That supply line has been cut. The al-Assad regime fallen now. So definitely this has had a major impact, and it effectively just confirmed that Iran's action retreat in the region.
What about Russia? Obviously, Russia has now given asylum to Bashar al-Assad. Where do you see Russia in this situation?
So, Yusuf, Russia should never have even been in Syria in the first place. You are on the Eurasian continent. You've got former Soviet republics who you can't control, who you've lost to the West. What on earth are you doing in Syria, 300 or 400 miles away from your southern border? You've got no influence in the Middle East. You don't need energy. You've got your own energy. What are you doing there? The reason why they're there is there's a problem with the Russian mentality, which is they believe they're a superpower. They believe they should be treated as a superpower. And they believe they should be involved in international issues because they believe they're a superpower. But they have this inferiority complex that why they're not treated as a global power. So what Putin and what the Soviets have done historically is they do things across the world to show we're a global power. So they'll get involved in Cuba, they'll get involved in Africa, and all of this is to show we're a global power. They can't influence things. It doesn't help anything strategically. So the problem Russia has now, they entered Syria and saved the regime. Then the war in Ukraine started. And now the Ukraine, the war in Ukraine is going on for 3 years. And the Ukraine war is just always going to be a million times more important. So Russia's problem is they believe they're a superpower when they're really not. So they do things to show that they're actually a superpower. When you do things to show other powers that you're a power, what can end up happening is like they've got now. You backed a leader. If you drop him, you look weak and no one else is going to work with you because they know if you work with Russia and things go south, Russia will actually drop you. So now Russia feels humiliated that Bashar al-Assad has fallen, but you should have never been there in the first place. And Ukraine it will always be the priority. So that's why I don't think the Russian intervention in Syria, at most, is a small to medium intervention. You're looking at about 5,000 troops, and most of these troops were flying jets or supplying for the fighter jets that Russia had, and they were bombing. And even the bombings were indiscriminate. Russia didn't put troops to go and fight on the ground there. So from that perspective, it was like an easy operation. But that's fine. But politically, you look ridiculous now because the leader you apparently backed has now actually fallen and been overthrown by the people. So what this does is, in effect, Russia is not as powerful as everybody believed. It couldn't even protect a leader that it managed to keep in power for, 5 to 8 years, and now it's been overthrown. So politically, this makes Russia look absolutely ridiculous. And it's worse, you should have never been in the first place.
What about Turkey? Obviously, Turkey was a key player in the region. It backed some of the rebel groups. Where did this development leave them?
So the Turkish foreign minister, Yusuf, he was at the Doha forum over the weekend. And all he could talk about when Syria was falling was the Kurds. The whole focus of Turkey for the last 13 years in Syria has been the Kurds. So the Kurds are from the northeast of Syria. That's where they reside. And obviously, you've got Kurds in Syria, you've got Kurds in Iraq, and you've got Kurds in Turkey. So these Kurds, they support the Kurdish fighters that fight in Turkey. The Turkey's focus has completely been on the Kurds, despite everything that's happening in Syria. Now, Turkey and Syria, historically, they've actually had quite difficult relations. There's border disputes between Syria and Turkey. And with the uprising, it did two things. Although it gave Turkey an opportunity to interfere in Syria, it also has led to many refugees going from Syria into Turkey. One of the things Turkey wants to do is get the refugees to actually go back. In fact, they want the refugees to go back, and Turkey wants to physically control the border. The other thing for Turkey is when America invaded Iraq, the neocons throughout the 1990s were talking about democratization, regime change. They went into Iraq and it turned into a complete mess. So to fix that mess, what America did was they turned to Iran. All the leadership in the new government, the political process that America established, was Iranian proxy groups. So what happened was Iran has gone into Iraq. Iran is in Lebanon. Iran technically has a presence in Afghanistan. Iran has a presence in Yemen as well. So countries like Turkey, countries like Egypt, countries like Israel, who are very close to America, they've been lobbying America for a long time that, look, we can work with you to achieve your interests in the region. Why are you working with Iran? And because Iran's become very powerful and Iran's in competition with them. So for Turkey, they've always had a problem with the Bashar al-Assad regime. And more importantly, they were worried about Iran's growing influence in the region. So that's why for them, this is actually a very, very good development that the regime has actually fallen. Interestingly, Turkey was actually opposing the rebel advance on the regime. What you find was they wanted the rebels to focus completely on the Kurds. But the rebels have always wanted to take land away from the regime and then try and take over the rest of the country from the regime. So you find Turkey sometimes agrees with this, sometimes it actually didn't. So you find actually this, because Aleppo fell so easily, even Turkey was taken aback. So Turkey couldn't stop the rebel groups now going all the way to Damascus when the groups can see the regime's actually finished. Because for Turkey, their priority has always been the Kurdish northern areas. Their priority hasn't been the regime in the south. In fact, Turkey has actually reached out to Bashar al-Assad, but he didn't play ball. Bashar's thing was, so you want me to make the north of my country autonomous so you have influence over that area. And Bashar al-Assad's view is, I've defeated the uprising, I've defeated the Arab Spring, I'm the legitimate leader. So he didn't want to talk to Turkey. His view was, I'm going to use my military to take back the northern area. So this battle that happened in Aleppo was Bashar sending his forces to take back the north, take back Aleppo fully, and then take back the Idlib area where these guys were. But obviously the opposite is what's happened in the end. So both HTS and the Syrian National Army, the two groups that took over Aleppo, they came down to Damascus. Turkey has been working very closely with them. Turkey has been arming them and training them. And the Syrian National Army, the SNA, they've actually been fighting for Turkey in Libya and other places as well. So these rebel groups that are going to come to power in Syria, Turkey has a very, very deep relationship with them. And what this shows is Erdogan has no regional agenda. What Erdogan does is he gets involved in issues of the region and he works with the global powers for them to achieve their agenda, but he takes credit for doing it. So people praise Turkey's doing this, Turkey's doing that. But if you to ask Turkey, what's your agenda? Why are you in Libya? Why are you in Armenia, Azerbaijan? Why are you in Africa? Or why are you involved in Palestine? What you find is there's no grand plan. What it is, they're part of the plans of other powers. We've seen that in Palestine now. Erdogan built his whole career that I'm going to defend Palestine. When it came to the needs of the Palestinians, where they needed Turkey to intervene, Erdogan's nowhere to be seen. So really, although this is a positive development from a Turkish national interest perspective, on another perspective, it actually exposed where Erdogan really stands.
How likely do you think the groups at HTS and the other factions within Syria, how much can they push back against Turkey? Can they become an independent nation, or are they always going to be basically a proxy for Turkey?
They can be independent if they want to. That has its own challenges. For the moment, the rebel groups are going to take power. Their focus is going to be internal. Their focus is going to be on, you know, rebuilding the country. So that doesn't really impact the foreign policy of other regional powers. Now, even if you look at the operation they carried to take over the country, what you find, Yusuf, is if Turkey didn't give them arms, if they had no access to arms, how would they fall? So that creates dependency. And the interests of Turkey, they overlap with the interests of the rebels, but they're not the same interests. So if Turkey pulls the plug, they potentially can have a problem. Now, Turkey itself has been caught out. They didn't think the regime was going to fall like this. In fact, the rebels were caught out. They didn't expect it. So if Turkey cuts the supply line, it will become a problem. And because Syria has been at war for 30 years, the country is decimated. And this is a challenge the Taliban's having at the moment, Yusuf. Taliban is one of the, Afghanistan is one of the most poorest countries in the world. Sanctions have been put on them. And they've now taken power. They've done the hard work. Now they're doing the more harder work of actually running the country. And if a few years go by and the situation doesn't change for the people will turn against them. So in a way, Yusuf, they've done half of the job. The other half and the main job is now outstanding. And that has got significant challenges. And that's what they're going to have to navigate. And if they do things which Israel or Turkey or Egypt or Saudi America feel is a threat to them, or they do things which is trying to change the architecture in the region, then potentially what each of these countries could do is back an opposition group against them. And that will lead to infighting and stuff like that. And we've seen that. We've seen that in Libya, where different powers are supporting different groups. That can potentially happen. But at the end of the day, because their focus is national at the moment, you don't really need foreign help. I mean, there is going to be an issue. They're going to need financing and development and these sort of things. But when it comes to infrastructure, usually it's China doing the building. So that's always an option for them. So again, this is something we need to watch. The feelers they're putting out, Yusuf, leave a lot to be desired. So we'll just have to wait and see how this turns out.
What about the US? Trump tweeted and was critical of Obama even getting involved in Syria. Surely the fall of al-Assad is a good thing for the US, who's always criticized him.
So just to give you a quick overview of Syria-America relations. When America emerged the global superpower after World War II, one of the first countries it did a coup in 1947 was in Syria, where Hosni Zayn was brought to power. He only lasted for 6 months. And what happened was, Yusuf, is the architecture in the Middle East was created by Britain and France after World War I. So when America emerged as a superpower, America realized that most of the monarchies were pro-French, pro-British, and most of the leaders there were created by Britain. So what America did is started supporting officers in order to overthrow the leaders Britain and France had put there, and it was in order to bring these countries closer to America. And the reason why America did this in the Middle East, and we see it in other places in the world as well, well, this is an important region. If it's an important region, you want rulers who are loyal to you, who are going to protect your interests. So Syria was the first place they did it. And Syria, if you look at the map, Yusuf, it has a border with Turkey, it has a border with Iraq, it has a border with Jordan, and it has a border with Israel and Lebanon. So if you control Syria, you basically get access and can try and gain influence in all these countries around it. And also, if you want to protect Israel, having Syria with you is also very useful as well. So that's why you find, Yusuf, time and time again, historically, America and Syria have been able to work together. So we see in Lebanon, they work together because Lebanon was controlled by the European countries. We see in Iraq, the first invasion, second invasion, Syria was with America. And as I mentioned, when it came to black sites and torture and these sort of things, you find Syria and America being able to work together. And actually what you find, Yusuf, is Syria in the past had backed jihadi groups in the region, which have served America's agenda. So what the US strategy seems to have been with Syria is we're going to work with this country, but how do we control it? So the way we control it is we isolate the country from the region. We make it a pariah in order that we can control it. So what you do is nobody can engage with it. You make it a pariah. And then you engage with the country by effectively saying, we're going to work with, we're going to remove sanctions as long as you do X, Y, and Z. And that's a similar strategy we see them use with Iran as well. Also, Yusuf, keep in mind, when the Arab Spring started, what was Hillary Clinton saying? What were Americans saying? Bashar Assad's a reformer. We need him in the region. So despite him being isolated for the last 13 years, all the talk of the last year has been normalizing relations with Bashar al-Assad. But what you find in the end, US support for the groups, really they saw that as more advantageous for their policy than supporting Bashar al-Assad in the end. And I think you've got to keep in mind, Yusuf, that America's strategy in the Middle East is the balance of power strategy, which is you have multiple powers and you offset them against each other. So if one country becomes too powerful, you back the other one. So America doesn't have a problem working with different countries. So in this region, America has worked with Saudi, Israel, Iran, the Gulf countries, Syria. It doesn't have a problem chopping and changing. So that's why Bashar, despite America propping him up for so long, they've just let him fall. They're not, it's not a personal thing here. It's basically they have no problem. Also, Israeli officials have convinced many American officials that let's change the security in the region. And Israel is a reliable partner for America to work with in this region. And obviously, Israel wants this because if America's working with Israel, then America's not working with Syria or Iran because Israel has a problem with them. So coming on to Donald Trump has always had a problem with America's presence in Syria. And I want to give you a quick example. In his first term, Trump was in a phone call with Erdogan of Turkey. And Erdogan asked him, "I don't understand, Mr. President, why are America's troops still in Syria?" And Trump said, "Yeah, it's because we're fighting ISIS." And Erdogan said to him, "But you've defeated ISIS, so why are your troops still there?" And Trump was, "You know what, you're absolutely right." So Trump got off the phone, he gets on his own phone, and then he tweets, "I've just spoken to Erdogan, why on earth are we in Syria? We've defeated ISIS." And then he declares on Twitter, "I am removing American troops from Syria." It took Congress a week to pass a law that he has to authorize that with Congress, and they don't authorize it. So Trump has always had a problem. And remember Trump, these forever wars. Why are American troops in these countries fighting a war where we don't need to be? So that's why he tweeted, and he was trying to blame Obama, that we shouldn't even be here. Why are we even in this country? However, the narrative I've given you of America's relationship with Syria, America's relationship with the region, America, how it views Syria, it has deep relations and it sees Syria playing a very, very important role. This is Trump's personal opinion that he tweeted, but his personal opinion is firstly against what America's been doing for decades. And then secondly, remember, Trump, he does things for his support base, that why on earth are we in Syria? Our troops shouldn't be here. What he does after when he comes to power will potentially be the complete opposite. And he has a long history of doing this as well. So for America, despite how useful Syria has been, America's got many cards to play with and it doesn't mind chopping and changing leaders who it works with. And that's what it's done here.
Adnan, a final question to end. Have the Syrians won the Arab Spring, is what we discussed at the start. Have they shown the region how to do it?
So the Syrians, Yusuf, they've been through a lot. As I described, this was a cruel, sadistic state. What they've done is they've done half of the job. So 50% they have succeeded. The remainder of the job still left to do yet. And, you know, you've got to hand to them. These are not countries you rise up in. Libya, Syria, you rise up, you will go to prison and never see the light of day again. They've done that. They've done the hard work. The whole world is coming out as support for them. People who are not Syrian are feeling Syrian today. So definitely they've done half the job, but the other part of the job is left yet. They rose up to remove the regime, but the regime didn't represent them. The systems, architecture, structure the regime established that didn't represent them. In fact, they oppressed them. So you've done half the job by getting rid of the regime. Now you need to get rid of all the things that the regime used to oppress them. So we're talking institutions, we're talking about the secret services, the defense establishment. All the structures need to be uprooted and replaced, and then to be replaced with those things which are in line with the sentiments of the people. If that doesn't happen, then what was the point of the last 13 years? You're just changing a few faces, which is what the regime offered you. So what Syria has shown is when the people unite, when groups unite, when opposition unite, they can overthrow the most brutal dictator. And that's what Sharia has shown us. However, the other half of the job is left yet. So for the Arab Spring to succeed, they need to do the second half now. But they've done the hard bit, which is to get rid of the big rock that was standing in the way.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. Hopefully we can get this out before too much changes on the news. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolitics.com, all one word. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.